Hello and welcome back to the Trauma Super Conference. My name is Jaya Bristow and I'm one of your hosts. And today I am so happy to be joined by Dr. Alex Ian Taffy. Welcome, Alex.
Oh, thank you so much, Jaya. I'm so happy to be here for this Trauma Super Conference. Thanks for having me.
Of course. Thanks for joining us today. So Dr. Alex Ian Taffy is a certified family therapist, gender specialist, sex therapist, somatic experiencing practitioner, clinical supervisor, and author of many books, including Gender Trauma, Healing Cultural, Social, and Historical Gender Trauma, which is what we're going to be talking a bit about today. So in your book, Gender Trauma, you start from the foundation that a rigid gender binary has not always and universally existed, but rather that it's part of settler colonialism. So what exactly do you mean by that?
I know, right? It seems like a really big statement. But what I mean by that is that I think we take it for granted. You know, sometimes people say, well, this is fact and this is science that there are two genders, right? Male or female, or that there are two sexes, you know, male or female. And I'm not even going to get too much into the differentiation between sex and gender and whether it's questionable or not for this, because it's not really the topic of the conference. But what I mean by that is that actually that has not always been the case. So, for example, at the moment in most Western countries like the US or Canada or Italy, where I'm originally from, or the UK, we think that, you know, the gender is really connected to certain biological characteristics, right? So we have a pretty gender essentialist notion, it's called, and that's kind of part of biological determinism. And I know those are a lot of big words that that may or may not be familiar to listeners. And if they're not, I do break it down a lot more in the book. But what I mean by that is that what we are experiencing right now is just a very specific theoretical way of looking at the world. And that's not always been the way that we have all looked at the world. And it is not the way that many people all across the globe still look at the world, right? Mm-hmm. When we look at across time and space, actually what we find is that gender has been much more expansive than two categories. And also that gender as and is not always being predicated on bodies, right? At the moment, we think about gender very much connected to like what genitals somebody has or what secondary sexual characteristics or what hormones are dominant, you know, in our bodies. Are we testosterone dominant? Are we estrogen dominant? And so on. But that is not the way that everybody thinks or has thought about gender. For example, gender sometimes has been much more predicated on social needs and social structures. Mm-hmm. And so we haven't always thought about gender in this like two very neat boxes that we seem to have nowadays. And actually those two neat boxes have been really imposed on much of the world through the ongoing settler colonial project or settler colonialism or neocolonialism, depending on where we happen to be on the globe, right? And so this is not always the way we thought about gender. Gender has been expansive in pretty much every corner of the globe we know of across time and space. And what we have come to understand as kind of natural, so to speak, it's a product of a very specific view of the world that tends to be this kind of Western European settler colonial view that is very influenced by Christian supremacy as well. And I feel like I've gone to so much more there around, you know, even the doctrine of discovery and how the idea of ownership is also really connected to gender, right? If we even think about how marriage is predicated initially, right, when it starts in Europe on ownership, right? Who owns what? Who owns land? Who is the land passed on to? Matrilineal, patrilineal, you know, all of those kind of ideas are really about social structure and dominance up to a certain point. And that is not the way that we've always thought about gender. And that is not the way that some people have ever thought about gender, even though we now tend to think like, this is just the way it is, right? Babies are born and they're boys or girls. And I'm like, it's actually a lot more complex than that. Mm. I don't know if that makes sense. I could say more, I could say less. I feel like this is a topic I could go on and on, but then when I get lost in my own, like, in my own mind and kind of my own arguments, I want to make sure that all those things are making sense. And I'm happy also to talk about why I think this is so important to dismantle in terms of trauma and historical trauma specifically.
Mm. Well, I think we can maybe cycle back to that. But for now, mm-hmm. I'm interested in, you know, on a very like present way, how mm-hmm. does everything you've just talked about, how does that impact like trauma and all of us living today? Like, how does this historical legacy of trauma impact people today?
Absolutely. I think that there are numerous ways in which this legacy impacts people today, right? So one way in which is really obvious, actually, it's kind of the impact it has on trans people and gender expansive people, right? We have seen kind of the oppression and systemic violence that many of our communities experience. And it's not an accident that most of the systemic violence is being experienced by trans feminine Black and people of color and Indigenous kind of trans women, for example, and gender expansive femme folks. The reason is because there is such a connection between racism, misogyny, and patriarchy, and it becomes pretty much impossible to talk about gender in any really meaningful way without talking also about race, without talking about indigeneity as well. And so in terms of trauma, we see this impact globally of systemic violence against trans women, mostly trans women of color. And we also see kind of the impact also on Black cis women and Black cis men as well, in terms of the systemic kind of racism intermixed with misogyny, sometimes called misogynoir, for example, when it's aimed towards Black women. And we see it in sports even. We see how often kind of Black women athletes are questioned around their gender if they excel, for example, right? Mm. And so there are so many examples. And here in what is now called the United States, where I currently live, we see the number of kind of murdered and missing Indigenous girls and women. And again, that is not an accident. There have been many reports and studies that have really shown the connection between that legacy of settler colonialism and the current situation of kind of missing and murdered Indigenous women and girls, and also to spirit folks and gender expansive folks here. And part of that is really how we perceive, how gender is perceived, and then how gender is kind of treated on a social level, whether it's through education, whether it's through media representation. For example, the missing and murdered Indigenous women is very underreported here in the US. And when it's reported, it's always with the lens of victim blaming, right? There is this lens of kind of almost or drug use that's being put kind of on the victim, almost to justify that this has nothing to do, right, with patriarchy or settler colonialism. This is the fault of the people this is happening to. And we see that again and again, the victim blaming, right? And we can talk about victim blaming on so many levels, but I think in terms of trauma, that is what we see more starkly, this connection between kind of race and indigeneity and gender, and that combination of how our bodies are gendered and racialized and viewed through kind of dominant culture, and how that impacts people on a day-to-day basis, which sometimes it's hard to see if we have gender privilege ourselves, or also racial privilege, or, you know, other forms of privilege. And like I said, there are so many examples. Even, you know, even if we just kept it to like cis white straight men, which is in some way we could say are kind of at the top of the hierarchy, this ideas of gender even impact cis white straight men. For example, we see in research evidence that they are less likely to seek healthcare support, for example, when they're facing healthcare issues, which is really this legacy of kind of toxic masculinity, of men as having to be fit and having to be the provider, also, you know, not talking about feelings very much, not looking for help. And then we kind of see this legacy in kind of this not looking for healthcare support when it's needed, and therefore developing kind of healthcare issues, having, you know, seeing the impact of what happens kind of on a marriage when somebody becomes disabled. There are so many examples that we could draw from, but for me, they all kind of cascade from this idea that the more we restrict gender from a trauma perspective, the more we contract around gender and we get more rigid around gender, the more negative impact that has on our bodies, on our psyche, on our emotions, both on a collective level and on an individual level. Whereas I think historically, we see across the globe, gender being this much more expansive, and also don't want to romanticize the past, but there is more expansiveness. And settler colonialism brings kind of a rigidity, a contraction, and a policing of gender, and not just gendered, but gender and race together, if that makes sense.
It does. I think there's probably a lot in what you're saying that's really interesting, but is maybe, you know, for those who are unfamiliar with all these concepts, that might be a bit overwhelming. So
absolutely.
Just to like simplify a little bit, like what I'm hearing, first of all, is that, you know, gender trauma impacts everyone. You gave some examples about, you know, trans people, especially trans women of color, but also, you know, and indigenous women and all of that. But like you say, you know, straight cis and cis meaning cisgendered, which is the opposite of trans, straight cis white men can also experience gender trauma, right? So it's this thing that is really universal and impacts us all. And often people think it's relegated to just the fringes of society.
Exactly.
So what's something that you would like, you know, what's something you would really like people to take away who are from this interview, people who are listening to this? What's a really important point that you'd like them to understand about gender trauma?
I think what I would like people to understand is to start questioning some of the things that we've learned through history or through education, because some of those things, and even through science, some of those things are not really correct. I think there are lots of people even on social media saying, but this is science, this is facts. And actually then there are biologists going, a little more complicated than that, right? And historians going, a little more complicated than that. So I think if anything, I want people to take away that gender is a complex biopsychosocial and historical construct. And we cannot think of it in absolute terms. So, and you're absolutely right. This is complicated. Like I stewed on those things in my mind for years and years and years. I have a PhD in what used to be called women's studies. You know, nowadays would probably be called gender studies. I am old. You know, so I've studied gender from a kind of sociological and psychological perspective. I read a lot about gender. You know, I think a lot about those issues as a gender scholar and as a therapist. And it is complex because what we're bringing together is this kind of all of this biopsychosocial experiences with history as well. And here we are in kind of the storm, we could say, which at the moment is really impacting sometimes the most vulnerable among us, right? We're seeing that with trans children and now they're being targeted by a lot of people. And so I think that kind of really thinking about how those concepts of gender are not universal, they're not always the same, and maybe questioning them a little bit more and thinking about, what did I learn about gender growing up from school? What did I learn about gender growing up from my family? What have I internalized in terms of gender identity, gender roles, gender expectations about who I should be and who other people should be in the world? And is that in alignment with my values or not? And even in popular media, there is this kind of questioning that the way we look at gender has absolutely changed. There's a popular Netflix TV show, Lucifer, which I really enjoy that TV show. And there's an episode where there's Adam, you know, the first man, according to the Bible, comes back to Earth in kind of contemporary LA, right? And he's really having this kind of crisis, right? When I was created, you know, there was an expectation that I would be like, you know, conquering things and naming animals and, you know, being tough and being strong. And now it's really different. And what does that mean for who I am? And now men can be vulnerable. And actually being vulnerable is really scary. And so it goes back to this idea that even when we consider maybe dominant experiences, we could say, so just like the experiences of cisgender kind of white men, there is still kind of a crisis there. And I think we're seeing that crisis in a number of ways, and in also in how cis white men can be radicalized, for example, where I live here in the United States. And I think that is a direct kind of, there is a direct line between what's happening now and that kind of historical trauma and the positioning that we have experienced in a number of ways, if that makes sense.
That does make a lot of sense. And as you say, you know, things are changing and evolving and shifting, but of course we're all impacted by our history.
Yeah.
And I mean, our history, both on a personal level and like intergenerational history, as well as on a broader level, like you're talking about, like colonialism and all these, you know, settler colonialism, especially as you're saying, especially in the US, for example, but you know, in Europe as well, there's all these different things. So coming back to a personal level, how do you feel that like this gender trauma is passed down generation to generation?
Absolutely. You know, and I said our trauma kind of constricts, right? And if we are therapists and healers, we know that trauma brings a lot of rigidity, a lot of constriction, and a lot of all or nothing thinking, a lot of polarizing, right? Whereas when we are not carrying the trauma in our bodies, we can be relaxed and alert and expansive and relational. And so in a lot of ways, what we're seeing from generation to generation is the passing on of that rigidity, that passing on of that policing, right? If you think about how often, for example, just really simple examples of mothers to daughters can pass on a lot of expectations around whose needs come first, what the role is supposed to be in a household, what you're supposed to be in the world. And sometimes that pressure can even be not just in traditional roles, it can also be in more expansive roles, right? The pressure of like, maybe, you know, feeling that pressure of having to be more expansive, of going beyond femininity, even if you really value femininity, right? There can be pressure on either side. And intergenerationally, often what we see is also the passing on of implicit messages. One of the stories that I share, for example, in gender trauma, which weaves kind of, you know, scholarly facts as well as my experiences as a therapist and occasionally some of my own experiences, because I really truly believe in kind of weaving the knowledge together, is being brought up with the story of one of my aunts through marriage, actually great aunts through marriage, kind of being sent to the US, never having met my great uncle because he had lost his first wife and there were these children who needed to be parented. And she was getting older, you know, probably she was in her 30s at the time. And so she was like shipped off to this other country, didn't speak the language. And I met this great aunt kind of later when I was a teenager. And there was a part of me that internalized, right, if you do not make your own path, your family will make your path for you. And it can also be really scary, right? What is the role of somebody who's positioned as a woman in the family, for example, right? And so, and similarly, you know, we could talk about pressures kind of from father to sons and also in both directions too, mothers to sons and fathers to daughters, right? And none of these expectations are absolute, right? They're all dependent on our own family context. And those intergenerational patterns can be so woven and complicated because they're also influenced by things like our religious or spiritual beliefs. They're influenced by class. They're influenced by race again. They're influenced by disability and so on. None of those things are really in isolation, so to speak. So, for example, we might look at kind of legacies of expectations around the level of education that somebody should attain, or the level of income or prestige that somebody should bring to their family. But also we see it in things like the intergenerational legacy of domestic violence, for example, which is a type of violence that is often very gendered, and usually I would say very gendered. That is also part of the legacy of gender trauma, right? Mm-hmm. And so there are so many things that we might not pay so much attention to or connect together, but they are kind of actually connected together. You know, and again, there are so many different things that influence all of those decisions. I remember, again, in my family, just because those are sometimes the easiest, most accessible examples that we have, right? My mom didn't have her own room, whereas her brother did. She didn't get to have her college paid, but, you know, her brother did. It was like the first boy went to college. There wasn't enough money, right, to pay for both of them. And so, the son was chosen because there was a different expectations of what sons and daughters could attain at that specific moment in history in that specific geographical and class location, right? And those stories are going to be different from family to family, depending on all those intersections and times in history, right? But none of us are exempt. Even those of us who think very critically about gender, who spend a lot of time thinking about it, I often say that, you know, this kind of ideas and ideologies, we could say, are like the air that we breathe. We get into our lungs without us noticing, right? And for example, especially my oldest kid has often called me on, like, hey, I think you are doing that thing where you're treating, you know, my friendships with boys different than my friendships with girls growing up. That compulsive thing. I was like, oh yeah, compulsive cis heteronormativity, right? And some, this is a story I share kind of her consent, but it's so easy to fall into the trap of reproducing those patterns, right? Because we have really, we feel them in our bones, often they're ancestral patterns. And so it's so easy to fall back into them if we, even when we pay attention actually. And sometimes we can also swing that away because trauma, right? So if we've had pretty oppressive upbringing around gender, we can swing that away of just putting a lot of pressure on the next generation to be more, you know, to rebel to expectations more, or to be more expansive. And maybe that's not what they want, right? So it can also kind of, as trauma often does, kind of swing in the other direction and still be rigid and constrictive, if that makes sense, right? Rather than being kind of in this kind of more fluid, relational, expansive space.
Absolutely. And I think there's a few really key points in everything you've just shared. And number one is that when we're talking about like social, cultural, collective identity and trauma, it's really hard to like isolate each thing, right? So if we're talking about just gender or just race or just sexuality or just disability, you know, and all those things intersect in society, first of all, right? And yes, then within each individual, even more so. And then when you add in the like individual's family, and then, you know, as you said, these things change from family to family, they change from generation to generation, they change depending on the person's gender, the age. You know, when I compare my experiences to my younger brothers, it's always hard to know sometimes, were we treated differently because of our genders, or were we simply treated differently because of our ages, right? And my parents and learned a lot more by the time my brother had come along, and also their financial situation was very different when my brother came along. And so there's all these different factors, and it's really hard to isolate. This is a complex topic, and I think it's really important for viewers and listeners to you know, recognize that it's not something that can just be easily fixed overnight, right? Or even as you say, you've been studying this for so long, and your eldest child still calls you out on so many things, right?
Oh, absolutely. So, you know, none of us are perfect on this. Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. So I think that's one really crucial element. And I think also what you're saying about how we can so often fall from one rigid set of rules or one rigid set of structures straight into another one, right? So, mm-hmm. You know, these days, you know, if we look at like, you know, you were talking about your parents' generation and your mom not mm-hmm. having her own room, but your uncle
mm-hmm.
was allowed. And then same, you're talking about your great aunt being sent off and stuff. And, you know, A, that wasn't that long ago, first of all, I think it's important to recognize. But even for people who say, oh, well, we've moved past that, we moved into a new era. But now there are other expectations. You know, I know, for example, as a woman, the pressure to like do it all and break all the glass ceilings and raise a family and do this, you know, for example. And so I think that there's, yeah, some really, really important elements in what you're saying. So I'm wondering if you can speak a little bit more about how this kind of gender trauma, really, but like these gender expectations, these gender roles, this engendered life can impact so many people on a day-to-day, in our day-to-day lives. What are some other ways that that happens?
Absolutely. Oh my God, there are so many examples, right? And even kind of in popular culture. And I love that you said gendered lives, right? Because one of the things I really believe is, even for maybe people who identify as a gender or outside of the gender binary, right? gender is part of the structures of our society, literally architectural structures, right? How we build bathrooms and changing rooms are gendered, you know, part of our educational structure, part of our legal structure, right? How we think of marriage, how we think of divorce, you know. I was brought up in a country, Italy, where there was still kind of murder because of passion was looked at differently. And what that meant really was usually men murdering women being justified under the law. Just so many different examples of gendered lives, but we often don't think about it through that lens unless we step back and we go, hang on a minute, what is going on here in terms of gender? But on a day-to-day basis, it's even like, you know, and there's been so much research on this. Who does the labor in the home? Who does the labor outside and inside the home of like cleaning and cooking and meal planning and making sure that if you have children, that the children get to the activities that they need to get to. If you have the class privilege to go on vacation, who gets to plan the vacation and who gets to make sure that everything is ready and everybody's packed, right? And so this is just a small example on a day-to-day. And then even on social media, right? A little while ago, I think this was a few years back, there were all these t-shirts that were going around and these memes around rules for dating my daughter, right, from fathers of daughters. And a lot of that was about ownership and reinforcing this idea that almost like if you are a girl, you don't have your own kind of sexual autonomy to decide how an agency, right? And that somehow you go from one protector, the father, to somebody who's potentially a predator in terms of boyfriend or potential partner, right? And that there is this kind of lack of agency then the girls have. And they looked very benign and we can all like laugh at them. But then when you pause and you go through them and you're thinking, hang on, what are those things saying, right? And I've even felt it as a parent of like a girl, like, you know, at first relationship, I was like, who is this person? And what do I want to know? And then I had to step back and be like, my child, you know, has autonomy and agency in her life. And we can talk about things. And if she asks for my opinion, I can give it thoughtfully. But this is not up for me to decide. This is like she has got her own agency, right? And I think a lot of things that are part of our day-to-day of our gender lives, we can sometimes laugh off as kind of this is the way things are. You know, it's the boys will be boys and a little pat on the back. But what are we really saying when we say boys will be boys? First of all, often what we're saying is that it's okay for boys to be disruptive and also distractive, whereas it's not okay for girls to do either of those things. But even for boys, that is not always good. Sometimes that means that some boys are facing quite a bit of horizontal as well as vertical violence, but they're supposed to protect themselves, even when they're children, you know, even when they're like preteens or teens, because that's part of masculinity, right? Mm-hmm. So even those things that, you know, boys will be boys, you know, don't be a sissy, for example, you know, all of those kind of things do have an impact on the day-to-day lives of people and become internalized by our children, who then kind of are deeply shaped and impacted by all of this. And again, we can't separate all of those kind of gendered aspects of our lives from anything, from any other aspects of our identity, right? Even just in the last few days on Twitter, there's been a lot of discourse, for example, around this new documentary, I think it's King William, about, you know, the Williams sisters, you know, Serena and Venus, and like their success, and why some white feminists have felt that why center a man, right? And a lot of Black feminists have said this is where there is a difference between white feminism and Black feminism. This is not just individualized, right? It is not just centered around men and patriarchy and individualization. This is really about the collective. And this is about daughters who wanted to celebrate kind of this family and their, you know, really uplift kind of how their father made it possible for them to become who they are. And there isn't this kind of separation between individual and family and culture and social context, right? And so a lot of what I say, even in the book, and I do say that and again, it's not necessarily new. I just bring a lot of ideas together from a lot of different fields and a lot of different scholars. But those are things that many people have talked about for a long time. You know, if we look at the culture of like purity bowls here in the US, or even just more straightforwardly, in a lot of Christian cultures, there's this idea the father gives away the daughter mm-hmm. when they get married. What does that represent? That represents that the girl child is property to be given away to another man. That's where it comes from historically. And I know people sometimes think like, oh, you're really exaggerating. That is just symbolic. And I was like, great. Tell me what it is a symbol of. When you give away, you know, somebody to somebody else, it's like moms don't give away their sons to a wife. So this is obviously a gender dynamic, which goes back to Eve being created out of the rib of Adam, right? The idea of ownership of women by man is part of Christian supremacy. And you don't have to like it, but if anybody comes up with a better interpretation of what the symbol means, I'm open to it. But usually that is kind of the symbol, right? It's like, and it goes back to, again, not that time long ago, where in many places women could not own property and what then that meant for their lives, right? And a lot of those things are not that long time ago. You know, a lot of like some of the stories I was telling about my great aunt, this, you know, we're talking about post-World War II. That is not that long ago, you know. My mom was born right at the end of World War II. So this is like the last 70 years. This is not even that long, right? And if we go back 100 or 150 years, it's even more, right? Yeah. Right to vote, which is obviously not everything. And how that also was not just about gender, but also about race. Right? Mm. So many, many layers there to unpack. I don't know if I answered your question, but that's what I was thinking of when you asked that question. I was like, there are examples like every day that I can think of. And some are kind of smaller and some are bigger. But when we step back, I think there are so many opportunities to see how many examples we have all around us. We could look at Disney princesses and how they've evolved over time, right? We could look almost at any aspect of popular culture in some ways.
Absolutely. Again, there's so much in what you've just said, but I think one of the key points that's being highlighted to me is something you said right at the beginning when you started answering, where you said, if we just stop for a minute, take a pause and think about it, right? And that's the problem. So much of this stuff is so embedded in our everyday lives that we don't even notice it anymore. You know, things like, I don't know, pockets on women's clothes, for example, or not just exactly, yes. Not just pocket. And if we look at the history of why that is and the fact that men were meant to carry the money and everything and women were just meant to look pretty, for example, or, you know, if we look at, there's so many things. And when you were talking about social media, the thing that came to my mind was the targeted adverts on social media.
Yes.
And so my social media must know that I'm a woman because I get adverts for makeup, for a period products, for underwear, for, you know. And then the other day I was scrolling through my social media and there was an advert for a drill or some kind of machinery. And I was like, this is so cool. And it's at that moment that I noticed just how often the adverts are gendered, right? Except mm-hmm. that then I realized as I watched the advert, it was for a drill that's actually a cleaning product. So it's not really, it's like, you can use this drill to clean your shower. And it was like, oh, I'm being advertised cleaning methods and cleaning products, not machinery. Like, I never get advertised like cars. And then when I look at my brother's or my father's or you know, any male friends or partners' social media, they have totally different adverts, right? And again, totally. It's just that society reinforcing these like things. And so if we don't stop and think, then we just keep repeating because it's embedded in us. So it's really that taking the time to stop and think, whether it's about, you know, the symbolism of marriage, whether it's about what ads are being targeted at us, whether it's about, you know, why women's clothes are not only have don't have pockets, but are also so much tighter and less comfortable than clothes being sold to men. And then, you know, if we go even beyond the binary of looking at just men and women, but looking at why people get so like afraid and like upset about the fact that some people are trans, some people are non-binary. Yeah. And it's like, why is that so scary? What is it like questioning in that individual that that's confronting for them to know that some people are trans and or non-binary?
Absolutely. And part of the what's scary is like the fear of questioning what we know, right? Partially is that fear that it's very human. Humans like certainty. Humans like what we can control. And there's so much that is uncertain and out of our control. And when we're questioned in our core belief, it destabilizes us. So in terms of trauma, right, we are destabilized. And often when we're destabilized, we lash out with fear. And often that fear becomes fight, right? And so if the presence of somebody who's gender expansive, like myself, for example, freaks somebody out, because then what does that mean? Right? And what does that mean for their safety? What does that mean for the way they've organized their life? Right? Mm-hmm. And we're seeing this again and again. I mean, we're seeing it in the UK with the gender critical movement. We're seeing it in the US. We've had the worst year yet for anti-trans bill being introduced in a number of legislation across the various states. And so we are seeing that fear in action and that wanting to restrict and police. And even, you know, the small things like the targeted adverts or the way that things are gendered on a day-to-day might not look like trauma, but it's not any individual thing. It's the compounding of all of that, that then the compounding of all of that, that then kind of contributes to rape culture, the compounding of all of that, the kind of contributes to kind of a cisgenderist transphobic world, the compounding of all of that, that's also part of white supremacy, right? There are so, you know, we can look at anything and go, that is small, that is not traumatic. But when we take the full picture and we add it all together, really, we see how all of those different small messages add up to certain, you know, to the way that people are treated differently, for example, in a court of law. There's a lot of research that shows that if, and again, a lot of this is very binary, just because that's also how we've organized our knowledge. You know, so it's very much based on kind of cisgender folks and men and women. But there's been a lot of research around the criminal system, you know, criminal industrial complex, and how if women have committed a violent act or that's considered against nature, so against nurturing, they're judged much more harshly than men, for example. So if they've done something that's considered outside of a woman's nature, there's a lot of implicit bias that means they're going to face harsher sentences. And of course, again, then if we compound that with race or class, then that becomes even more clear. And so when we take any one small thing, it might seem easy to brush it off. But when we then take it all together to look at what is the cultural and social environment which they contribute to, then it becomes a much larger issue. And the last example I'm going to mention is, I was giving a webinar about increasing access to work for trans and gender expansive employees. And of course, the topic of bathroom came up because it always does when it's trans folks, and all we want to do is just pee in peace like everybody else. But this always comes up. And there was somebody who was very activated about, but what about the safety of cis women who might have also be, you know, survivors? And I have to say, as a survivor, this is a topic that's really close to my heart. I really, truly believe that, you know, there's not a lot of safety in this world often for survivors, but policing gender in bathrooms, that's not what we need, because quite clearly having gendered bathroom has never stopped anybody from assaulting women in bathrooms. And also, much as some of the violence against women is perpetuated from outsiders, we know, again, from evidence, this is not opinion, these are all facts that come from research, that the biggest threat to most cis women are their cis male intimate partners. You know, you're much more likely to be murdered in many places because of intimate partner violence, that kind of stranger danger. But again, you're brought up with this idea that stranger danger rather than it could be your father, it could be your brother, it could be your husband. They are the people that you actually need to be really cautious about sometimes, right? But we don't want to talk about that because that kind of shakes up our expectation of the world, which is home should be safe. And the reality is that home is not safe for a lot of people. And some of those reasons are gendered. So yeah, I don't know if any of that makes sense, but hopefully it gives an idea of how even the small things can contribute to a much more pervasive and dangerous culture and social environment in the long term.
And I'm so glad you brought that in, because that was actually going to be my next question. So you've already answered that for me. But, you know, I think, again, people can be very dismissive, as you say, of the small things. So what if I get advertised cleaning products and menstruation products mm-hmm. rather than like tools? Let's be honest, I use more menstruation products than machinery anyway. So, you know, whatever. But it's not really about that, as you say, you know, it's a symptom of a much larger issue. And as you say, again, like people who get so caught up in like the gender toilets and the idea of safety, it's like, no, again, that's a symptom of a much larger issue. And if we start, you know, looking at all these gendered rigid roles and this patriarchal white supremacist culture mm-hmm. and, you know, all these symptoms, and we zoom out and we look at the fuller picture and start trying to change the systems, and the first step to that is awareness and acknowledgement, then suddenly that will no longer be as much of an issue, you know. So I really, absolutely, really appreciate you bringing that in. Thank you.
Yeah, no, thank you. And it's like I said, I think that small things are easy to dismiss or laugh off. And I totally get it. You know, nobody wants to spend their time looking at how pervasive and painful some of those things are, quite frankly. Like even when I was writing the book, it was such a painful process to really reflect on just how much gendered violence there is in the world in every direction. Right? And it's like there's so much gendered and racialized violence, and they really go hand in hand. And it is painful to look at that. But if we turn away from that pain and from that wound, then we are ignoring it and the wound festers. And I think we have seen the festering on a global level in many, many ways, you know, and it is not an accident in the world. So seeing the rise of kind of fascist thoughts and feelings in a lot of different places around the globe, right? None of those things are completely separate. And often some of the messaging that's associated with that is really gendered. And again, that's not an accident.
Absolutely. And I think, you know, another really important point is that, you know, like the problem is not men, for example. The problem is patriarchy. We are all, whether we identify as men, as women, whether we are trans, non-binary, whether, you know, whatever, whether people are male or female or intersex, wherever people fall on the gender mm-hmm. sex spectrum, we are all victims of this really messed up gendered culture, which is created so that certain groups have dominance over others, but it doesn't really work. In the end, we all lose. And I think that that's really important. And I really hope that that's clear to people listening, that it's not like pointing the finger at any particular gender or at any particular group. It's showing that the system is broken and we're all victims of that.
Oh, actually, I think the system is working exactly how it's supposed to work, you know, but I totally get it, because I often say that too. The system is broken. Then I'm like, hang on a minute, think about the system. Oh, no, the system is working. Mm-hmm. It's just working for a very small number of people, right? Which is how it's supposed to work. And as well as I totally 100% agree, and often that's the thing that I really want to put across, it's not about individuality. It's about systems, right? It's not, no one gender is bad. I actually think that all genders are beautiful, and I want a world in which gender is so expansive, that masculinity and femininity and gender expansiveness and all expressions of masculinity and all expressions of femininity and all expressions of gender freedom and gender expansiveness, all of that can be celebrated and there's no competition. But systemically, that's not the world we live in. And I think the danger is also, as well as us all being victims of that system, we can also be agents of that system without noticing. I remember, you know, after the, I think it was the 2016 election in the US, a colleague at a conference was like, I think this is, you know, the results of this election is about internalized misogyny and the fact that women couldn't bring themselves to vote for Hillary Clinton, right? For example, not to make it political, but to give real world examples, right? And I had to look at her and just be like, yes, and this is not just about gender, it's also about white supremacy, because it's white women who voted in a specific way. So if this was just about misogyny, we wouldn't see a divide, not just across gender, but also across race, right? We would see Black women and white women, for example, voting in the similar direction. This was about misogyny. But this is not about misogyny. This is about the upholding of white supremacy on which the country I live in right now is founded. And I think we would be really hard pushed to argue that that's not the case at this point. I hope that anybody with a reasonable grasp on history can see that whether we like it or not, that is the foundation. And again, then because part of whiteness is individualizing everything, you know, I see sometimes white folks here kind of collapse under shame, right? White is bad. Like, nobody's saying that. And what people are saying is that whiteness is a category that was constructed to uphold a certain system. And we need to be aware of that, because if we want liberation, we need to dismantle those systems. And I think, you know, if we want gender liberation, we've really got to be aware of how the systems work together. And if we want more expansiveness and healing for all of us, it can't just be healing for some of us, right? Mm-hmm. And also, it's not a hierarchy. You know, I've had sometimes friends, you know, I have a lot of second wave feminist friends because I'm older. Those were my teachers and mentors, right? And some of them are still struggling and like, well, you know, we still don't even have equality for cis women. Can't you just wait your turn? I'm like, this is not how it works.
Yeah.
This is not about taking turns, because this is not an individualized issue. Mm-hmm. And there's not like a little pyramid of who's more important and who gets their needs met first. And, you know, this is about the collective. As long as, you know, if we think of the collective as a body, if I've like smacked my finger, which I did yesterday, actually carrying a box and like really hurt my joint, the whole body is going to be impacted by that pain. If I like break a leg, the whole body is going to have to adapt and carry the hurt, right? So if we think about humans as a collective, as long as there is, you know, parts of us, so specific population or specific folks that are hurting or being oppressed, the body is not well, right? Mm-hmm. And so having this idea that somehow it's like, first we liberate those folks and then we liberate those other folks. First of all, who gets to make the list, you know, and who gets to decide who got there first, right? That is very questionable. This is like the argument about who created science fiction that's going around at the moment, right? It's like, who gets to decide who was there first, right? And so that is not how we can approach the issue of healing from gender trauma. We need to look at it systemically. We need to look at how pervasive it is. And that can be overwhelming. And that's okay if that's overwhelming for a little bit, as long as we don't just collapse, as long as we find a way to kind of participate into action, if that's what we want, or at the very least, kind of be able to sit back and observe, if nothing else.
Absolutely. So how do we do that, Alex? How do we heal from gender trauma? How do we, what does that look like? How can people, you know, other than the thing we've already mentioned, which is take a pause and think about it, like, and look at it. What are some other ways that people can start doing the work to heal from this collective gender trauma?
Oh, you know, I wish I had the easy answer, TM, that I can like sell, because capitalism, we haven't even touched on how capitalism also impacts all of this. We talked about property, so I think that we kind of brought it in a little bit. You know, if I had the answer, that would be great. But as with many things, there is not an answer. I think there are lots of potential answers. I think that having an awareness of our deeply brands is definitely the first step, right? If we're not even aware that our leg is broken, we're just going to keep walking on it. We're in pain and we're like, I don't know why I'm in pain. I'm so tired. You know, we don't know our leg, maybe as an airline fracture or something. So first of all, that awareness is so, so important and so foundational. And then I think there is a decision to make about whether, you know, what is the part of work that's for us? I think, again, because of that ongoing settler colonialism and white supremacy, often even in activist movements or as healers, we feel we have to do all of it, right? We have to do all of it and we have to respond to every crisis. And given the input on a global level, that is just impossible, right? There is so, you know, there is a climate crisis, which is also not separate from, you know, kind of the impact of colonialism and the impact of all these other things we've been talking about. There are so many things to attend to. So partially is knowing that we are part of a much larger collective and we don't have to do everything because that would be impossible and we would get burnout. And so sometimes it's like, what is our part, right? For me personally, I know that one part was parenting, right? What is it that I wanted to make sure did not get passed on to my children, right? And so one of the things I knew I didn't want to pass on, for example, were certain gender expectation, also relationship with food. We haven't really touched on that, but that can be also gendered and size and body image and all of that. And so there's a piece, I think, for parents to think about what is getting passed on generationally when we parent. But, you know, trauma is not just passed on vertically. So from generation to generation, it can also be transmitted from peer to peer. And so it's also thinking about what do I want my relationships with others in my life to look like? Are my relationships kind of in integrity and alignment with my values or not? How are they being impacted by ideas of gender? And they probably are, I would say. And, you know, if you're a teacher, what are the resources that you're using? What is it that we're teaching our children, right? If you're an architect, how are you designing like a public space environments? How are you designing kind of structures that you're putting out there in the world, right? If you are working in the Federal Aviation Administration, only because my oldest is training to be a pilot, right? Let's look at kind of gendered rules. Let's look at like ableism. Like this is pervasive in kind of every aspect of our life. And so I don't know that I have an answer, but I think a piece of like is to just look at your own life and look at your own world and not just around you, but within you as well is what do I need to heal for myself and what would I like to contribute to healing in the world, right? And for me, I think, and for a lot of other trans and gender expansive folks, some of the work, not for everybody, but for some of us, some of the work we've chosen to do is around gender because we have so much pain around it. Mm-hmm. And so, and for me, I chosen to do that work even before I was aware of being trans, right? When I started my PhD in women's studies was actually because of that gendered violence and that intergenerational piece around domestic violence. I was really interested in doing that work, right? And so what do we need to, and as I healed within myself, then the expansiveness came in and then more of the landscape was revealed, right? And often I think we want to have an answer and a trajectory, and I don't know that that's possible. I think we all take stock of what we think is our work in the world. You know, often I have a really lovely close friend and healer who often asks like, why are you here? And so I would say to the listeners, I would pose that same question. Why are you here on this good green earth at this point in time? It is not an easy question to answer, but why are you here? What is your work? And no work is too big or too small or significant or insignificant. We need the collective, right? It's like we know mosquitoes are significant to the ecosystems, ants are significant to the ecosystem. Not everybody is a redwood, right? Thankfully, because that wouldn't be a very good ecosystem if everybody was a redwood or a birch, right? And so why are you here? What is your work? And as you learn more and more about how our gendered lives might impact your work, maybe that's a good place to start, if that makes sense.
Fantastic. Well, That's a lot of great advice. And what I'm hearing is question things. Take a moment to pause and question things. Look at your own lives. Look at the influences and impacts that, you know, you've received and start questioning those. And then start questioning the impact you're having on others, whether that's your peers, your children, your colleagues, your nieces, your adopted niblings. I'm Auntie Jaya to a lot of children. I don't have any of myself, but I have many friends who do. And, you know, that's something I really, you know, luckily a lot of my friends are aware of these issues, but some more or less than others. And that's something I really want to bring as Auntie Jaya. I want to be the person who can, you know, talk to these kids. They're all babies at the moment, but as they grow up, about these issues. And, you know, so I think that's wonderful advice, Alex. How can people find out more about you and your work?
Sure. Well, people can go to my website, which is finally up to date, thanks to one of my wonderful mentees that has got skills that I was able to pay for. So you can go to alexyantafi.com, and all my books are on there. Some of my books are also available in other languages now, which is really great. Gender Trauma is not yet, but you know, hopefully it will be. If you are an educator or a healthcare provider or a therapist, you know, we're all trying to survive under capitalism. This is my book, Gender Trauma, Healing Cultural, Social, and Historical Gender Trauma. It's not very long. It's pretty accessible. Some people liked it, you know, there's some endorsements in the back. And what I do throughout the book is I really try to tie all of these ideas kind of together in a much more coherent and guided way. So I start from kind of how did we get here? And there is the historical perspective, what's happening now, kind of how does gender trauma shows up collectively, all in the family, how is that perpetuated through generation to generation? And then how does it manifest in relationship? And then I end with how does it manifest in system and toward healing. And maybe that's a good thing to finish with is actually reading the last paragraph, if that's okay, of the section on towards healing, which is collective dreams, visions, and possibilities. And in there, I say much better that I think about on my on two feet is, I believe the healing from gender trauma lives in the spaces between us. The spaces across which we try to reach for one another when we dream of community, when we create structures centered around healing, justice, and liberation, when we strive for disability justice and access, when we dare to envision inclusive spaces. There is no definite answer here, no listicle I can give you or magical formula for how to fix the painful impact of this historical, cultural, intergenerational, and social trauma of a rigid gender binary. However, I believe that if we can start to notice the wound, engage with it critically, start to clean it up within and between ourselves, we can start to plant seeds for another world of possibilities. This is a world in which we're connected to the past, where we do not deny or erase our history, but we do not get stuck in it. Rather, we move forward reclaiming what is ours and creating anew what was destroyed. This book is a long, open-ended invitation to this dream of gender liberation for our collective healing. How will you respond? Mm. And so that is really the intention of this book. It is an invitation throughout. There are educational stretches, I call them, because it's kind of those moments where I really want people to stretch beyond maybe what they've learned. There are clinical vignettes for people who are therapists. So it is very much focused on counselors and therapists, but I've heard that people who are in education and other fields have really enjoyed reading it as well. It is pretty accessible. I think for the general public too, even though it is mostly aimed at kind of for academia. So if you want to find out more about the conversation we've had today, this is a good book to start from. You can go to my website. You can follow me on Twitter at xtaffi, X-T-A-F-F-I. I think that's it. You can invite me on things, invite me to your conference, invite me to your podcast. I'm still waiting for a call from Oprah so that any of our books can go on our book club, but that's okay. Just keep putting it out there in the multiverse.
Well, you never know. Maybe she'll be watching.
Exactly.
Thank you so much for your time today, Alex. I really, really appreciate it.
Thank you, Jaya. I appreciate you as ever.